I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. The Kaiser Family Foundation asked Americans about the Affordable Care Act passed by Congress 3 years ago and found there was a great deal of confusion and misinformation. 42% said they didn't even know that the act was the law of the land, and 40% said they didn't like the law. Only 37% viewed it positively. Half of those polled said they didn't know enough about Obamacare, as it is referred to by even President Obama, how it would impact their family. It was even higher for those who would benefit from the new health care law, those without insurance and those with low incomes. The second most popular source, though, for information about the Affordable Care Act, according to Kaiser, was radio news, online news, and newspapers. So we are here to help. And we have two guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. David Grandy is an assistant professor of medicine at the University of Pennsylvania, where he's a senior fellow at the Leonard Davis Institute of Health Economics. He was last on the show when he was in medical school. And David Grandy, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Also with us is Robert Field. He's a professor of law and professor of health management and policy at Drexel University. He writes a regular blog for Philly.com, The Field Clinic, and starting on Sunday, he'll be answering questions about the reform, about healthcare reform, on the Philly.com health page. And Robert Field, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Happy to be here.
So Robert Field, why so much confusion? It's been 3 years since this was passed by Congress, signed by President Obama, upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court almost a year ago, and yet many people are misinformed and misunderstand this law.
There are two sides to that. One is it is an incredibly complex law, and anything you do with health care is going to be complex. Health care is complicated. Think back about 10 years when George Bush put through a health reform plan to add a prescription drug benefit to Medicare. There was massive confusion. There was disruption. The websites crashed, and it took a while to work itself out. Today, it's actually a very popular benefit. So to be fair to Obama, it is quite a daunting task to communicate this. On the other side, he has been inexplicably quiet about this since the very beginning. And he's in the business of politics. Politics is all about communicating.
Yeah.
He should know, and his people should know, that you have to communicate anything, even if it's simple, and this is not simple. To get the Massachusetts program up, the Romney Care program from 2006, they had a massive public information campaign. They had ads at Red Sox games. They had promos on TV. And that seemed to have helped. So far, we haven't seen anything along those lines.
Well, picking up on that, and actually something we were talking about before going on the air, David Grandy, was the press conference earlier this week. President Obama was asked about the Affordable Care Act. He went on for I have two whole pages of his answer to that question, a very wonky response, a very sort of by the book, uninspired response to that question.
Yeah, you know, again, I would agree with Rob that I think that, you know, health policy and healthcare reform is a very difficult topic to communicate. And certainly, you know, many aspects of this law were meant to maintain the system we have in many ways and to bring regulation to the private insurance market, which is inherently complicated. Trying to get the private insurance market to do what we want it to do and cover people and do so in an affordable way requires a tremendous amount of regulation and complexity. And I think that that makes it hard for the president to communicate that, you know, why he's struggling so much to do it. You know, in part, I'm sympathetic to, but also would hope that he would be able to do a better job.
But Robert, do you think, I mean, if there were some kind of a bumper sticker, I realize you can't put 2,000 pages onto a bumper sticker, but some kind of, you know, 7-word description about what this law is about.
You know, when you go back to the debates in 2009 and 2010 over the law, the opponents, the Republicans, had some great 2-word sound bites: death panels, socialized medicine, government takeover, costly program. The Obama side and his supporters had none. They would go on for sentences trying to explain the 2,000 pages. I always thought calling it the guaranteed coverage law would have made a lot of sense, because that's the guts of it. If you cut away the 2,000 pages, you can get to those 2 words. And if he just kept repeating that, it would give people a sense at least of why it was passed.
But do you think it's the critics of the law that have mounted a disinformation campaign that have been winning this argument?
They have mounted a disinformation campaign going back to the death panels, and they have been winning it, but they've been winning it by default because the Obama side has not been putting up a fight. And they could look at what his adversary Mitt Romney did in Massachusetts just about 7 years ago. It is possible to communicate the guts of this law, and it is inexplicable as to why they haven't really tried harder.
I had a sort of a preventive procedure done recently, you know, no problems, no nothing, just kind of regular care. I didn't have to pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm pretty informed about this law. And when I left the office, I thought, wouldn't it have been great if the receptionist had given me a little slip of paper that had said this service was provided and essentially paid for by the Affordable Care Act. I mean, there seems to be this disconnect, David, between getting the service and what people experience about the service and understand about it.
Yeah, I think it's asking a lot of patients to really parse out what parts of their health care are due to the Affordable Care Act, which parts aren't. You know, I think at the end of the day, if you look back over 100 years, every health reform debate in this country's history has involved the same exact arguments, the same exact rhetoric, and it's very effective at mounting opposition. Mm-hmm. The difference here, of course, is that a law was passed. And so, you know, it's easy to get caught up in the moment, I think, but time will tell, I think, as the law gets implemented, because the way people learn about their health insurance and the way people learn about their health care is by using it. I think if you look at American workers when they go through the process of picking a health insurance plan that their employer offers, it's a complex process. Many don't understand it. And the only way they come to know whether they made the right choice is by starting to use it. And I think the same will hold true here. As people start to use the health insurance exchanges, get signed up for insurance, that will be the true test.
Well, going back to you, Robert, certain parts of this law, certain provisions are in effect. And
Right. We
should just underscore what they are so people know.
Okay. So the big ones are if you are below the age of 26, you can't get employment insurance through an employer, you can go back on your parents' policy. It used to be you were cut off at age 19 or when you graduated from college. If you have an individual policy, there's no longer a lifetime cap. That doesn't affect most people, but if it does, if you have to have cancer treatment, something like that, that could be a huge difference. And the insurance company can't rescind the policy unless you've actually committed fraud. They can't sell you a policy and then once you get sick say, sorry, we changed our mind. And then there's the preventive care issue. You get preventive services, whether it's a vaccination or a checkup or a screening, for free now with no copay. So those are the main things that are in effect. We've also seen some minimum benefit standards for policies. So a number of policies have actually been providing better coverage. And all of that's been in effect for a year to 2 years now. And, of course, most people don't even realize it.
Well, just picking up on the policy part, that I guess the insurers have to provide a certain percentage of their money into care, right?
That's right. So it doesn't directly control the prices, but it says that the insurance company can only have an overhead rate of so much. Right. And that's 15% if it's a large employer policy, 20% if it's a small employer or an individual policy. And last year they actually did send people rebate checks. So that there was a tangible financial benefit. The other benefit is under Medicare, the infamous donut hole under the Part D coverage, where there's no coverage for about a $2,000 gap. That's gradually being shrunk. And within the last year, seniors have actually gotten a rebate check for that as well.
Going back to you, David, part of the Affordable Care Act was to hold down costs, or at least try to contain some of the costs. Some of the criticisms is that costs have gone up or are going up, or they're parts, I guess, of the economy where we're seeing some of the costs going up. What's going on here?
Well, there's a few things going on. One is clearly the Affordable Care Act, number one, was a coverage bill. That was the main focus of it, is how do we get people covered and how do we fix the insurance market of people going out and buying insurance on their own, which largely doesn't work today. With respect to costs, there's certainly an approach in the Affordable Care Act, which was to try a whole bunch of delivery system reforms and see if some of these things work. And I think we don't know yet. There are many pilot programs and other things that are looking at changing the way doctors and hospitals are paid, the way care is organized, and whether that can lead to more cost-effective care. You know, but we don't know the answer yet.
And if we're talking about covering everybody, as it stands today, Robert Field, what percentage of the population, how many millions of people don't have health insurance. And obviously, this is the key part of the provision that's
right,
going to take
right.
effect.
So right now, it's somewhere around 49 million people don't have insurance. That includes some immigrants. About 10 million or so are legal immigrants. About 5 million are legal. About 5 million are undocumented immigrants. But it is about 15% of our overall population. The law won't completely eliminate that. It will help to cover about half of them. But that's a huge reduction, and that will be a lifesaver, literally a lifesaver for many people.
But is the idea that if you get more people covered, that spreads the costs out, and then people are not using the emergency room as their doctor's office?
So there are ripple effects throughout the healthcare system and throughout the economy. If we get everyone covered, insurers can spread the risk. It's easier to sell policies to sick people without bankrupting the insurer. It's also a huge lifesaver for the providers. The hospitals, particularly inner-city hospitals, have been lobbying vigorously to have Medicaid expanded and to have this overall law go into effect. The AMA actually supported the law in part. Part because it would mean that doctors would have to have fewer uninsured patients they'd have to chase down.
So the idea, David, is to get young and healthy people into the system, and that will help to manage some of the costs?
Absolutely. So, if today you started from scratch and just went and sold private health insurance to individuals, it would be incredibly expensive for people who are sick and very cheap for those who aren't. And that's very rational behavior by an insurance company. And that is why the individual insurance market, which is the market where if I pick up the phone today and call a local insurer and try to buy a policy on my own, doesn't really work, because the people who need insurance the most can't afford it. The people who are healthy can afford it but don't feel like they need it. And so this takes a perspective over people's entire life and says, at some point everyone is going to get sick. Everyone is going to need health care, and we need to get everybody into that system at a young age. And I think that's what the whole law kind of sits on, is that math of bringing young, healthy people into the mix.
And within the insurance world, is that a revolutionary idea, Robert Field?
No. Actually, the idea of structuring the market that way goes back to Richard Nixon. In the 1970s, he was looking for a marketplace way to reform healthcare and extend coverage, and they came up with the idea of forcing everyone to have a policy, and that would allow the companies to spread the risk and to insure the people who were older or sicker. One of the great ironies of American political history is if it hadn't been for Watergate, we might have had this 40 years ago, and it would be called Nixon Care instead of Obamacare.
But you're talking about the mandate there,
I'm talking
right?
about the mandate
which
part
this,
of it.
Which...
Well, that's the key part. That's the way that you get the healthy people into the pool. That's the way that you get them not to say, I'm not sick yet. I'm 25, say, I don't expect to get sick, so I'll wait till I get sick to buy the policy. And economists call that the results of that adverse selection, where the risk pool is selected for the people who are adverse to its functioning, the people who are going to incur claims.
Let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Robert Field. He's a professor of law and professor of health management and policy at Drexel University. David Grandy, assistant professor of medicine at the University of Pennsylvania, where he's a senior fellow at the Leonard Davis Institute of Health Economics. Today on Radio Times, everything you ever wanted to know about the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-9499. WHYY. Questions or comments? Give us a call. We'll be right back.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. Fox Chase offers lung screening for individuals at high risk of lung cancer. Based on results of a national trial which showed death from lung cancer was reduced by 20% with early detection. Qualified candidates receive a low-dose CT scan and an appointment with an advanced practice clinician to discuss the results that same day. More at foxchase.org. Fox Chase Cancer Center, now part of Temple Health.
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen with a quick reminder about the important role you play at WHYY. You're a listener, and we figure that's because you like what you hear on shows like Radio Times, Fresh Air, All Things Considered, and Morning Edition. What you need to do next is become a supporter to ensure that WHYY can continue to keep you up to speed on news, on cultural trends, controversies, books, movies, you name it. Pick up the phone and make a pledge at 1-888-345-9499 or pledge online at WHYY.org. Thanks.
The Kimmel Center supports WHYY and presents Soledad O'Brien in Latino in America, Saturday, May 4th at the Kimmel Center. A journalist and correspondent for CNN, O'Brien will discuss a variety of topics, exploring how Latinos are reshaping our communities and culture and forcing a nation of immigrants to rediscover what it means to be an American. Tickets for Soledad O'Brien are available at 215-893-1999 or kimmelcenter.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with David Grandy and Robert Field about the Affordable Care Act, what provisions are already in place, what are on the horizon, and its impact as we understand it so far, and, of course, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Robert, you wanted to add something that we didn't really flesh out before the break.
Yeah, there's a point that goes back to what people can expect, and Obama made it in his press conference, but extremely anemically. He said that 85 to 90% of people won't see a difference when the law goes into effect. That's absolutely right. If you have employment coverage, most companies are going to keep their coverage. There might be some changes around the edges. Actually, the coverage might get a little bit better, but you're not going to see anything different. If you get Medicare, if you presently get Medicaid, you won't see any changes. It's the people who now get coverage individually, which is only about 5% of the population, people who can't get coverage at all. So we're talking about maybe 10, maybe 15% of the population at most who will see the effects.
That's that 40% you referred to earlier?
The
I mean, 40 million, excuse me?
Yes. So if you were to have asked someone in Massachusetts in 2007 when the Romney law went into effect, what change did you see? Most people would stare at you blankly and say, none. What was supposed to have changed? It's really just that segment of the population. And that's where I think the communication should be. He's got 2,000 pages of different provisions he could emphasize. That's the key one. That's where their message should be.
Let's talk about the exchanges, David, and they're being rolled out, I guess, supposed to go into effect in October. I read that something like 33 states have signed on to the exchanges that are in the Affordable Care Act. Other states have not. For those states that have signed on, what does that mean? How does that work?
Well, the numbers actually, the federal government is going to be responsible for about 33 states, far fewer than that. The remaining, of course, will be doing it on their own. And so there's been a lot of attention more so on the federal government right now since they ended up having to run many more of these exchanges than they had planned for. And at the same time, Congress, of course, hasn't been real forthcoming with resources or funds to help the Department of Health and Human Services pull this off. And so we don't have a lot of information about the overall state of preparedness. The administration has kept relatively quiet other than to say they will be ready.
Mm. In October or sometime in the
fall?
Yeah,
so they're supposed to start to begin screening patients in October for coverage to go live as of January 1. But as of October 1, consumers are supposed to be able to start going on there and kind of testing out their options.
And the idea is that you go online and you look at a bunch of different policies, right, and try to figure out what would work for you, how much it's going to cost, those kinds of things.
Yes. So the idea here was to create a single portal, you know, that's online or, you know, there's also going to be some paper-based options, but largely online where consumers can go on there and shop amongst a range of health insurance products. And there'll be some standardization to those products. So there'll be some less generous plans and some more generous plans, and they will fall into categories to try to guide consumers and give them some signals to say, here, this plan is cheaper, doesn't cover as much, it'll have more out-of-pocket spending at the time that you seek out care. This plan over here is more generous and will require less out-of-pocket spending, but it's going to cost you more right now.
And I guess, Robert, the question is whether it's going to be written in language that people understand and whether an individual by themselves can make a decision.
They've been working on that. They just actually shortened the application form from, I think, 21 pages to 3 pages and tried to put it into plain English. The way to think about this is a Travelocity for health insurance. Oh. And it will be like the comparison shopping where you get the list of flights and prices and how many stops they are. Presumably, you will get that for the health insurance as well. If someone wants to see what it's going to be like, it's, it exists in Massachusetts. You go to Massachusetts Health Connector Authority. I think it's healthconnector.org. And you can see one of these in operation. You'll put in key information, and then it will give you a menu of policies, and you'll check. There will be four standardized coverage levels according to how generous they are and prices to match, and then you'll pick the one you want. What will be really complicated is you'll have to enter your income. It will have to calculate whether you get a subsidy, whether to kick you over to the Medicaid program, what that premium is going to end up being, what your age is, whether you smoke. It's going to be a lot more challenging than Travelocity, but that's kind of the model they're pushing for.
And for those states that haven't, I guess, signed on to the federal version, I mean, where, and that includes Pennsylvania, where does that leave people living in those states?
Well, they will have an exchange. There will be a website. There will be a Pennsylvania website. It will be run by the feds, not by the state. You as a consumer probably won't see the difference. It's the behind-the-scenes work. It's the backroom work that's going to be a lot more difficult, actually, because it's going to have to coordinate with a lot of state agencies, with state Medicaid, with state insurance regulation, and so forth. But you won't see that. Hopefully you won't. Hopefully it won't crash, and it'll work.
Well, and speaking of crashing, and I've talked to a number of physicians, some who have been on the show, and some just that are friends who complain, frankly, bitterly about the e-records part of trying to clean up our healthcare system. How expensive it is, how much time it takes, whether the systems are all set up to actually talk to each other. Is that part of the Affordable Care Act, David?
Well, there was actually, before the Affordable Care Act was passed, was a law called the High-Tech Act. And that was what was really the big federal push to get doctors and hospitals to start using electronic medical record systems. And so that push actually predated the Affordable Care Act. So there's big financial incentives on the table for doctors' offices as well as hospitals to implement electronic medical records. And then the federal government is tying those incentives to making those systems do more things. And so one of the things that is one of the great frustrations in healthcare is being able to communicate with one another.
Yes.
I think patients are very frustrated when they see that their doctors are not sharing communication adequately. And this was supposed to be a vehicle to do that, and we're far away from that at this moment. That's turning out to be a long process of getting all these computer systems to talk to each other, which are all quite different.
Yeah.
So even locally, if you look at what's going on at Penn or Jefferson or other places or different doctors' offices, everybody's on a different system.
And that's not good for getting systems talking to each other. Robert, go ahead, and then we'll get to our callers.
Yeah. I think what's really scaring the Obama people is, can you think of a computer system that's been launched that's worked right? Ever. Think back to Windows Vista. Yes. Think to the websites that suddenly crash. They're going to have to come up with something in uncharted terrain. We've never had anything this complex, a shopping site like this. And it's going to have to operate. People's health and lives potentially are on the line here. You look back to the Bush program again of 7 years ago, and that had some real computer disruptions. So that's got to have them quaking in their boots. They'll do the best job they can, but it's going to have glitches.
What about banking? I mean, there's so much banking now online. Is that a model that could be used?
That is a model, and people keep talking about that for healthcare. Banking, we've had ATMs now for 40 years. How come we don't have anything similar in healthcare even now? So it can work, but even banking, you get stories about information that's posted publicly, sites are hacked into, systems crash, you can't get to your money when you need it. There's always going to be problems.
And that's Robert Field. He's a professor of law and professor of health management and policy at Drexel University. Also with us, David Grandy, an assistant professor of medicine at the University of Pennsylvania, where he is a senior fellow at the Leonard Davis Institute of Health Economics. And we had read about a study by the Kaiser Family Foundation finding that many Americans don't understand the Affordable Care Act, which was passed just about 3 years ago and upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court in June of last year. So we have invited, or we did invite, David and Robert to join us to help us understand what provisions are in effect, what's coming up, and what it all means. Let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. Looks like we have George from Worcester. George, joining us on Radio Times. Go ahead, George.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
I wonder what protects us as consumers from having these companies change things on us every so often. I'm with a Philadelphia-based insurance company at the moment. I started a new policy with them last spring. They raised my rates $20 in October, which was okay, but then they just called me and told me my rates are going up another $109 a month starting in July. And I mean, I was paying $270, so that's a huge increase to go up to $380.
And George, is this an individual policy that you have, or do you do it through work or through some kind of a group?
Yeah, I'm actually not working. It's an individual policy through Independence Blue Cross.
All right. Well, you're looks like you want to say something, Robert Field. Go ahead.
We're seeing a spate of increases recently and requests for increases, and some of them are quite draconian. Partly from the company's point of view, it's going to be disruption. They don't know exactly what it's going to cost to offer these new kinds of policies. They want to protect themselves. There is some back-end protection. That provision that says they can only spend a certain percentage on overhead means that if they have overestimated the premiums, you'll get a rebate. But that won't be for a year or so from now. The other side of it is, to be somewhat cynical, if you want to raise rates, what a perfect scapegoat to claim it's this new law and the government made you do it. So there's some of both going on.
What do you think?
Yeah, no, I'd agree with Rob. I think that the one other provision in the Affordable Care Act was to try to increase the review of those rate increases as well. So there should be more scrutiny in the future on insurance companies when they want to increase rates, you know, as we're hearing from the caller, about whether or not that's appropriate or not.
George, thanks for the call to Radio Times, and good luck as well. And just to underscore what you said, David, the Affordable Care Act was passed 3 years ago, but the rollout is really over a decade, right?
Yeah, I mean, in the next year will be, you know, we'll be 90% there in terms of all of the provisions being implemented. The last big thing to be implemented is really this big expansion of coverage. Everything up until now has been, you know, really at the margins. Small increases in coverage, as Rob pointed out earlier, amongst, you know, kids up to the age of 26, closing the donut hole, other things. But, you know, the big increase in coverage will happen over the next year.
Let me see what Susan from Abington has to say. And Susan, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. Thank you for allowing me to ask my question.
Sure. Go ahead.
I'm calling with regard to the coverage for 26-year-olds, up to 26-year-olds. We happen to have a daughter who's 22 and graduating college and happy that we can keep her covered, but yep. Now she's moving to L.A. to look for a job. Will my coverage, our family's coverage here in Pennsylvania through my husband's employer, cover her in L.A.?
Yes.
Okay, this is Robert Field.
Simple
Go ahead.
Answer, and
Go ahead.
I can tell you I have a son who lives in Brooklyn, and he's under our coverage here, so that won't be a problem. If she's fortunate and gets a job that has benefits, she'll have to switch to that, but she can stay under your coverage until either that happens or she turns 26.
Anything you want to add to that, Dave?
No, I think the one other complexity could be depending on the network of providers that's available. You could run into some challenges there with a family member living far away. So I think you'd want to look at what kinds of providers you can see in that insurance program and whether there are options out there on the West Coast.
Susan, thanks for your call to Radio Times. Excuse me. I know there's the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation, the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute, that there are a number of provisions, I guess, to provide a kind of watchdog part of the Affordable Care Act, Robert Field?
Different watchdogs. And to be perfectly honest, it's the Healthcare Academics Full Employment Act.
Is that right?
There's going to be a lot of research money out there and a lot of work done analyzing the system. Each of those hits a different issue. There's going to be an oversight board to look at ways to save money under Medicare. There's going to be a board, the PCORI, Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute, to compare new expensive technologies and see if they actually work. There's going to be the Center for Medicare Innovation to look at new ways of making payment and presumably new incentives so that doctors and hospitals won't be running up the bill. So, David, you probably are familiar with more of them even.
But not to be confused with quote-unquote death panels.
Not at all. No, these are largely –
Since that idea is still alive and well.
Yeah, not at all. So, you know, we have grossly underinvested in researching what works and what doesn't work in our healthcare system, both from individual treatments as well as to how we organize and deliver care. And a lot of these things are meant to try to begin funding some work in this area. Some of it is to actually fund the reforms to the system itself and then evaluate them, and some of it is just more research money. But we've really it's remarkable for how much public dollars we invest in healthcare, how little we spend on actually evaluating what works and what doesn't.
And just to underscore that, Robert, I was reading that Americans spend 2.5 times the amount of money on healthcare compared to our counterparts in European countries. Is that
Our healthcare system is ridiculously expensive. I haven't seen a figure that extreme, but I know our per capita spending is double what it is in Japan, and our life expectancy is much lower, and our chronic disease problems are much higher. It's about 50% more than in most of Western Europe. So we have the most expensive system in the world. This law will not make it any cheaper. In fact, it may make the situation worse because you'll have more people getting health care. But at least we'll be getting more for what we pay for.
Let me see what Cecilia from Wallingford has to say. Cecilia, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
We're a self-employed and self-insured family of four. I have always had a rider on my gynecological tract, and I have also a pre-existing condition. It's very difficult for me to get insurance with either of those things. Is it possible that there'll be some insurance available or some policy available for someone with riders on their insurance policies as well as pre-existing conditions?
Cecilia, I'm going to toss that to David Grandy.
So I'm not sure of your specific circumstances, but I think in general, when you're talking about whether a pre-existing condition will get in the way of you getting coverage and being able to afford coverage, that is one of the big changes that comes about from the Affordable Care Act and is the most popular provision, which is to say that you can't that insurance companies can't charge people more money based on any pre-existing condition or their health status. So two people who are 40 years old, regardless of whether one is sick and one is healthy, should be charged the same price for their health insurance. And that, you know, that's something that Americans are overwhelmingly in support of. But to do that involves a lot of things that are less popular. But to the caller's question, you know, without, again, knowing her specific circumstances, this does take the pre-existing condition issue off the table in terms of what it means for your health insurance premiums. And make sure that you wouldn't ever be denied coverage as well.
Yeah, go ahead,
so
Robert.
This caller is really the kind of person the law was intended to help. I mean, this is the guts of the law to make sure that you can always get coverage. Hopefully that's reassuring.
Cecilia, thanks for the call to Radio Times. But just to underscore that, when some of the provisions are broken out and the American public asked about them, they do like them.
It's interesting.
It's just the totality that seems to be struggling.
Yeah. When Kaiser has done their polls and break it down, every single aspect of the law, except for the mandate requiring everyone to have coverage, is popular. Some by 80-90%, some popular among Republicans by 80-90%. The mandate is unpopular. Who wants to be told you have to buy a product? On the other hand, when they rephrase the question and say, if it were necessary for a functioning insurance market to require everyone to get coverage, would you support the mandate? And then it's about 50-50. So I think it goes to show how poor the communication is, that people don't understand that this is what the law is all about and that they actually do support it. What they see is just this morass with subsidies, with spending, and it doesn't make any sense. And I can't really blame them for that.
Well, let's take another short break and we'll get back to our conversation. Again, that's Robert Field, a professor of law, professor of health and management and of health management and policy at Drexel University. He writes a regular blog for Philly.com, The Field Clinic, and starting on Sunday, he'll be answering questions about healthcare reform on the Philly.com health page. Also with us, David Grandy, assistant professor of medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. He's a senior fellow at the Leonard Davis Institute of Health Economics. 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY Westchester University Online Studies. From an accredited MBA to a master's in special education, convenient and flexible degree and certificate programs are available in several subject areas such as business, health, and education. For more information or to submit an application online, wcupa.edu/grad. Westchester University. Learn more.
I'm Marty Moscowane, and we are in what we hope is the final stretch of the spring membership campaign here at WHYY, and here's how it works. We take your pledge of support and add it to the thousands of other listeners who have made their pledges and invest that money in the programs that you enjoy, including Radio Times. So pick up the phone and make a call right now. That phone number, 1-888-345-9499, or pledge online at WHYY.org. You'll be glad you did, I promise, and thanks.
The Philadelphia Speaker Series, presented by Widener University, announces its 2013-14 season at the Kimmel Center. Seven engaging evenings with Apple co-founder Steve Wozniak, author Bill Bryson, former Greek Prime Minister George Papandreou, former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, poet laureate Billy Collins, Ambassador John Huntsman, and historian Doris Kearns Goodwin. PhiladelphiaSpeakerSeries.org, sponsored by WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, clearing up some of the confusion about the Affordable Care Act with our guests David Grandy and Robert Field, and again taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Yvette from West Oak Lane to join us. Yvette, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out that I see a lot of similarities in the health care insurance law and car insurance. And I think if the administration would bring out some of those similarities so that it doesn't seem as unique and different mandating insurance, because we already have, if you drive, there is a mandate that you must have insurance. And I think if we did the same thing with health insurance so that it doesn't seem as much of an outlier and something that has already been done, and, you know, the good that it will do if it is implemented, I think there are a lot more people that they could bring on board.
Well, Yvette, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, and I'm seeing some nods here as well. Go ahead, Robert.
I think that's an excellent point, and it's been made all along, but somehow it's got lost in the wash. Governments have been mandating insurance in many forms. For 100 years, we require employers to have workers' compensation and unemployment coverage. In effect, Social Security is you are forced to pay into a mandated retirement system, and we do have the auto laws as well. I guess one difference with the auto laws is they're done on a state-by-state basis. It's not the federal government telling everyone what to do, but the basic concept is exactly the same.
Yvette, thanks for the call to Radio Times. David Grandy, let me ask you about the impact on, I guess, the healthcare system, even the U.S. economy. If you add more people to the system, are there enough medical personnel to take care of them? Could this help deal with our jobs problem in this country by including more people in health insurance?
Well, there's all sorts of ways in which healthcare impacts the overall economy. Certainly, as we end up piling more money into the healthcare system, it means not spending money somewhere else. And certainly, we're seeing that at the state and federal level in terms of budgetary pressures. So every extra dollar we spend on healthcare at the state level is a dollar not available to spend elsewhere. But the broader issues, I think, in play in terms of some of the questions you raised about the workforce,
yes,
and whether we have an adequate number of doctors out there to take care of newly covered individuals. Certainly before the Affordable Care Act, there's been debates over decades now of how to improve the availability of primary care in our healthcare system across the country. And there's lots of shortage areas in the country. And there are ways in which this law will further stress that system. The good news is that I think many of the people that we'll be bringing into the healthcare system, probably their use of healthcare will be lower than average, particularly for young, healthy individuals. But it still underscores the need to try to figure out how are we going to have an adequate workforce? How are we going to bring other providers into that workforce, including nurse practitioners, to become part of the primary care workforce in this country?
I'm even thinking of data entry people, Robert. Just in terms of loading all this information into the system.
The insurance companies are going to need people. The government agencies are going to need people. The hospitals, physician offices, and the exchanges are going to have to employ people. If we look to Massachusetts as a sort of predictor of the future, there was a big primary care crunch. People suddenly had coverage. They went to get checkups. They went to have their kids checked out. it eased up over time, and the same will probably happen nationally. We'll have lines, we'll have waiting periods for some primary care providers, particularly in underserved areas, inner cities and rural areas where there aren't that many. But this is one of the things like the computer glitches that we're going to have to be patient. It will probably work itself out over time.
Let me see what Linda from Downingtown has to say. Linda, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, great. I have a question. I can't seem to get an answer from the Affordable Care Act website or anywhere. What I want to know is we are currently on a limited benefit plan called Special Care through Independence Blue Cross Blue Shield for lower income people. Mm-hmm. We are self-employed and our two children are on medical assistance because they're autistic. What will happen with those limited benefit plans? Because we are limited to four doctor's visits a year. There's no prescription coverage. There is no preventative care except what was mandated back in 2013. And I'm curious what would happen with these plans under the new act.
Let me toss that to you, David.
Well, I think probably your best option after the Affordable Care Act is implemented is probably to get out of that plan and into a new plan that would be available through these new health insurance exchanges or marketplaces. This is really what the law is intended to do, is try to provide more generous and comprehensive coverage and to provide financial assistance to people who need it. So anybody up to this magic cutoff of 400% of poverty, which for a family of four, I believe, is about $90,000 of income per year, will get some financial help. And so my guess is that you'd be a lot better off getting out of that insurance program, which I understand is quite thin in terms of its coverage, and get into a more generous plan with some financial help.
Now, Linda, thanks. Yeah, go ahead, Robin.
You're really going to have to get into a more generous plan because the limited plan won't meet the requirements for the mandate. The mandate says you have to have coverage and it has to meet certain minimum requirements, and if not, you're subject to a penalty. So probably your penalty wouldn't be very great, but the law is saying that to comply, you would have to get into a regular policy.
I'm curious about one of the descriptions of the Affordable Care Act, Robert Field, is that it's a government takeover of our insurance.
Right.
Yes, no?
In a sense, it is, but that's nothing new. This is something I've been actually writing a book on that's going to be coming out later in the year. Our system is a government-run system. It's just you don't see it. If you go to Europe, you know it's a government-run system. It's very visible. There's private sector roles, but they're more hidden. Here, the private sector is what you encounter, the private doctor, the private hospital, the private drug company. Yet behind each one of them is a set of massive government programs. If it weren't for Medicare, we'd have fewer hospitals. We'd have fewer hospitals, fewer physicians. We'd have less technology in our hospitals. If it weren't for the NIH, we'd have fewer drugs. If we didn't subsidize employer health insurance with a huge tax break, we'd have less employer coverage. Mm-hmm. So we actually – the government took over health care for all intents and purposes half a century ago. And if it hadn't, we wouldn't have the health care we have today.
Picking up on businesses, David, then we'll get back to our callers. What would, though, once all this is in place, what would prevent a business from saying to their employees, look, you know, the exchanges are out there. You're on your own. Take care of your health insurance by yourself. We're not going to be providing insurance through business, through our company.
So for large employers, they do have to pay a somewhat modest penalty if they choose to do that and their workers go out and get coverage through these exchanges. But what's interesting is I think that there's ways in which a mandate for people to have coverage could actually increase employees' expectations of coverage from their employer. Everyone predicted in Massachusetts that there would be an erosion in employer coverage after the implementation of RomneyCare there. And in fact, it was the opposite, and I think caught people by surprise, which is that employer-sponsored coverage actually increased. And I think part of that comes from employees expecting it.
You agree?
I do agree. A lot of the critics of the law say, oh, it's going to be the end of employer-sponsored coverage. They're going to pay the fine. They're going to let people go into the exchanges. But they're still going to be competing for workers. They're still going to have to show that they take care, that they care about the people who work for them. And that fine around the margins, it may not be worth it if you look at the competition for labor. So there will be some companies that drop coverage. Some of them would have done it anyway. Some of them might do it because of this law. But the positive side is if it does get dropped, now you're not uninsured. you can get coverage.
Let me see what Paul from Cherry Hill has to say. Paul, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
This has really been, first let me say, very informative.
Thank you.
But I've got a question that, I've been trying to read up a lot on this, and I can't seem to get an answer anywhere I look, which is I currently purchase my own family insurance, and I'm not sure what's going to happen to those policies once the Affordable Care Act comes into being. Will I need to purchase my insurance through the health exchanges, or will the insurance company continue to offer coverage that you can just buy independently?
Well, and I guess the question, Paul, is whether you would be forced then to use the exchange. Is that what you want to know?
Right. And could this potentially be creating two separate but unequal insurance systems?
Go ahead, Robert.
It could. That's actually one of the fears. You can buy policies outside of the exchanges. You're better off going through the exchange because that's the only way you can get the subsidies. So if you have less than four times the federal poverty level, that could be a lot of money to you. But there is concern that some people may go outside of the exchanges, get cheaper coverage. Maybe they'll risk having to pay the penalty for having a substandard policy, but it's worth it for them. And then the exchanges could suffer the same adverse selection mm-hmm. we were worried about to begin with, where it's just the healthy people and just the wealthier people who are going through them. But for now, my advice to you would be buy a new policy through the exchange if you can.
You want to answer that, David?
I would agree. I think that this is a fear of a lot of health economists out there is what is the market going to look like inside the exchange versus outside the exchange? Mm-hmm. And it's going to be incumbent on the government in terms of its outreach to get as many people to participate in the exchange and to try to get healthy people as well as sick people sign up. And if what we end up with is all the sick people are in the exchange and all the healthy people are outside, prices are going to be high in the exchange and they're going to be low outside.
And is it a carrot stick situation trying to get people into the exchanges? Both of you have used the word penalty.
A huge carrot in the exchange, which is that's the only place where you can get financial help.
Right.
So that should do a lot to address this concern. It would be highly unlikely that you would be in a better position outside the exchange if you're under 400% of poverty and can get some help.
And for those people, Robert Field would say, I'm not going to do it. I'm just mm-hmm. not going to buy health insurance. What happens to them under the system?
You mean do they get put before a death panel?
No. Don't even say that. I mean, there are going to be people that say, I'm not going to do it.
What will happen is you'll be subject to what is basically a tax assessment. The following year, starting in 2015, there will be a line on your federal income tax form saying, did you have coverage throughout the year? You can actually have a three-month gap. Mm-hmm. But aside from that, did you have coverage? And you'll have to submit some kind of certificate showing that you did. If the answer is no, it will add a penalty to that. The first year, the penalty will be the greater of $95 or 1% of your taxable income. Not a lot for most people. In 2016, it will go up to $695 or 2.5% of your taxable income. The question is going to be, will people lie? Will people just refuse to pay it? There's no means of going after you other than adding it to your bill or deducting it from your refund. So there's very limited enforcement if people decide to just ignore the whole thing and protest. Mm.
And that's Robert Field, who joins us along with David Grandy. We are talking about the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, what some of the provisions are, what's in place, what's on the horizon, what's in the future. And I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Let me get Nirosh from Princeton to join us. Nirosh, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, hi. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I just want to know if I understand it. I wanted to talk about the one portion of the Affordable Care Act that I think wasn't upheld by the Supreme Court, which was the mandatory Medicaid expansion. They said that can't be upheld, and now we're hearing state legislatures and some governors and a couple states that aren't going to opt in for the federal subsidy to expand Medicaid. What are those patients mm-hmm. who are presumably too poor to afford insurance on the exchanges and such going to do? How are they going to be covered, or are they going to be uncovered still?
Nirosh, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Go ahead, David.
Yeah, and I'm glad you raised that point because it's an incredibly important one. So this was the biggest unintended part of the Supreme Court's ruling that caught everyone off guard, which was to say that the federal government could not compel states to expand their Medicaid program. And so what that means is it's essentially voluntary for states to opt in or opt out. Now, there's a huge financial carrot on the table here, which is that the federal government for the first 3 years is paying 100% of the cost of the expansion of Medicaid. And after that, it gradually goes down to 90%, which is still incredibly generous compared to the current Medicaid program. But if a state really digs their heels in and decides not to do this, it leaves a big hole in the law. It means that you essentially have these provisions that will help people above 100% of the federal poverty limit, but that gap that exists between that point and current Medicaid coverage, which most people think if you're poor, you get Medicaid coverage, which is not the case at all, would continue to be a hole. And here in Pennsylvania, we're facing this debate right now. Our governor has not decided whether to opt into the Medicaid expansion.
Go ahead, Robert Field.
One of the cruel ironies is the people in that gap are going to be the people who need help the most. And another one of the ironies, it probably won't be enforced, is that technically they're subject to the mandate. And if they don't go out and buy coverage, they would be subject to the tax assessment. Now, the administration has said they're not going to enforce it against those people. But it's going to be this never land, which is going to be a big hole and is going to have to be addressed.
We're almost out of time here. I'll just toss this briefly to you, Robert Field. So what does this mean for providers? I mean, how much is their life being changed by the Affordable Care Act?
Yeah, it depends which providers you're talking about. If you're a hospital, this is probably a great thing. They provide a lot of indigent care. They'll provide a lot less of it. You'll have fewer patients going to the emergency room who could be treated by a doctor. For primary care doctors, it's going to be wonderful as well. And for other primary care providers, nurse practitioners and so forth, it's going to be a lot of new patients. For specialists, I think some of them will see more patients. I think some of them may see tighter controls from the insurance companies. But for the most part, I think providers come out ahead with this.
Well, I thank you both very much for joining us today in Radio Times. I actually learned a lot from both of you about the Affordable Care Act, and we should do this again in the fall. And again, Robert Field and David Grandy, our guests today in Radio Times, thank you both very much. David Grandy, Assistant Professor of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania, where he's a senior fellow at the Leonard Davis Institute of Health Economics, and Robert Field, Professor of Law and Health Management and Policy at Drexel University, and again, a regular blogger for Philly.com. The Field Clinic, and on Sunday he'll be answering questions about the healthcare reform at the Philly.com health page. Again, thanks very much for joining us. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program and stay with us. We'll be right back.